Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Prison Lawsuits and Private Guards Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 1st, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Minnetchi v. Pollard. The question in this case is whether prison inmates may invoke the Bivens Doctrine to bring suit against the employees of a private company hired by the federal government to provide services for the prison. To discuss the case, we have Alexander Volokh, who is an assistant professor at Emory University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Volokh.
Hi, this is Sasha Volokh, and I'm a law professor at Emory Law School. And I'm going to be talking about the recent Supreme Court case called Minnetchi v. Pollard. This is basically about Bivens liability of employees at a private federal prison. And let me give you some background about this case. This case started out in the Ninth Circuit as Pollard versus the GEO Group, Inc. Now, the GEO Group is one of the large private prison operators in America. It used to be called Wackenhut, and it runs a prison called the Taft Correctional Institution in California, and it houses federal prisoners there. Now, Pollard, Richard Lee Pollard, he was a federal inmate who was at that institution. And here's essentially what happened. He was incarcerated. He slipped on a cart that was left in the doorway. He had to be seen by the prison's medical staff, and he was x-rayed. They decided that maybe he had fractures of both elbows. They put him in a particular sling, referred him to an orthopedic clinic. Now, at this point, his problems start, which is that he says that they made him put on a jumpsuit that was extremely painful for him. It turns out that because of limitations in staffing, they said they were going to put his elbow into a splint, but then ultimately they didn't put his elbow into a splint, and then he couldn't feed or bathe himself, and then he had to return to work before his injuries had healed. So he had all of these injuries, and he filed a pro se complaint. And he says that his Eighth Amendment rights were violated. And the standard for an Eighth Amendment violation is essentially, this is cruel and unusual punishment, and the way it comes up in the prison context is usually it's deliberate indifference to your safety, or in the prison medical context, it's a deliberate indifference to your medical needs. So he had this Eighth Amendment claim, and he wanted money damages. Now, claims against prison officials seeking money damages are nothing new. We see it all the time. For example, if you are in a state prison, then you can sue the warden or the guards or whoever it is that you allege did the bad thing to you, your doctors. You can sue them under Section 1983. That's the standard civil rights statute passed shortly after the U.S. Civil War. And that's the statute that overwhelmingly is used for these sorts of civil rights claims where the plaintiff wants money damages. Now, of course, the Constitution doesn't say anything about what is the remedy for its own violation. So that's why, essentially, you need to have a statute like Section 1983 that says, well, here you get money damages because the Constitution is silent on the matter. Now, usually this is done in public prisons, but you can use 1983 if you're a state inmate at a private prison, too. In fact, in 1997, there was a case called Richardson versus McKnight. That was an example of a prisoner suing the private prison guards. And Richardson v. McKnight even had this extra twist, which is that even though public prison guards would have qualified immunity under 1983, private prison guards don't have qualified immunity under 1983. So that's a little twist. That means you can actually get even more money out of the prison guards if you are an inmate at a private prison. So now what makes this more difficult is that here, Mr. Pollard was an inmate at a federal prison, and Section 1983 only applies against state officials. It doesn't apply against federal officials. So for about 100 years, we had this regime where there was a claim against state officials for constitutional violations for damages, but you did not have a comparable claim against federal officials. In 1971, the Supreme Court fixed this. It was at a case called Bivens versus six unknown named agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And there, Bivens was alleging a Fourth Amendment violation. And, you know, if you're prosecuted and they use evidence against you, you already have an exclusionary rule to protect your Fourth Amendment rights. But if they don't prosecute you, what can you do? So this guy wanted damages, and the Supreme Court said, that's okay, you can have damages. So ever since Bivens in 1971, now there is also a damages remedy against the federal officials. Now the question is, how do the state remedies compare with these federal remedies under Bivens? And there we have a fundamental difference between the two kinds of remedies. The 1983 was actually passed by Congress, so there's no question that that's actually law that the federal courts have to apply. With Bivens, there was no congressional enactment. It was essentially an exercise in federal common law. Now, back in what Scalia calls the heady days of, this was in the 1970s, the federal courts were very keen on implying money damage remedies, implying private rights of action, things like that. Since then, the federal courts have cut down on that, and there's been more of a reluctance to expand the reach of federal common law. So in the 70s, Bivens was expanded to other kinds of claims, not just the Fourth Amendment. Most interestingly for our purposes, in 1980, the Bivens claim was expanded to the Eighth Amendment, where he actually did have a prison inmate case. This is at a public prison, a case called Carlson versus Green. So since Carlson versus Green, it's been clear that there is a Bivens action for prisoners in federal facilities, at least that was a public facility. Since 1980, the Bivens remedy has not done very well, and courts have routinely said that you need to find two things for a Bivens remedy to apply. You need to find that there are inadequate alternative remedies, and you also need to find that there are no other factors that might counsel hesitation. So, as an example, there was a case called Bush versus Lucas in 1983, where there was a guy from NASA who claimed that he was demoted because of his First Amendment rights, and so he brought a First Amendment claim under Bivens, and the Supreme Court said, no, you don't get a Bivens claim, because there are already comprehensive procedural and substantive provisions which give meaningful remedies against the United States. So we should not supplement that regulatory scheme with some new non-statutory damages remedy like Bivens. So in Bush v. Lucas, 1983, the guy lost. There was a case, Schweiker v. Chalicki, in 1988, where there was a person who was said that he was wrongly denied Social Security benefits, and he wanted all sorts of damages. But there the Supreme Court said, no, there are actually plenty of ways that you can get, you can't get complete relief if you're wrongly denied your benefits. You can get your benefits back, but you can't get emotional damages and other things. But that's okay, because we have an elaborate remedial scheme devised by Congress. And so we can't say that there are no alternative remedies or there are no special factors counseling hesitation. Since 1980, Bivens hasn't really had a very good life. One of the ways that it's been limited is there was a case recently, FDIC versus Meyer, where someone wanted to sue the FDIC, and the Supreme Court said, no, Bivens is only available against the individual, not against the entity. So you have to sue a person, not FDIC. So this actually brings us back to private prisons. We saw in Carlson that there is a Bivens remedy for people who are in public prisons, but what about in private prisons? So there was a case called Correctional Services Corporation v. Malesko, and that was in 2001, where you actually had a federal inmate in a private prison. It was actually a private halfway house of some sort. And he sued the corporation rather than the individuals on an Eighth Amendment theory. Actually, the reason he didn't sue the individuals was because he had a statute of limitations problem. And the Supreme Court said, no, you have to sue the individuals, not the entity. So that was essentially an application of FDIC v. Meyer. But the interesting thing is, if you read Malesko, then what it seems is that the Supreme Court is assuming that you can sue the individuals. You just can't sue the entity, but at least you can bring a Bivens suit against the individuals. It's just the guy didn't do it here because the statute of limitations had run out. This case, Minichi v. Pollard, actually raises that very question. You know, at this point, it's not even clear that someone can sue the individuals. So Pollard actually did sue the GEO Group, and he sued various individuals. Well, after Malesko, the GEO Group was dropped from the case because he can't sue the entity. But still, he has all of these claims against particular individuals who he claims injured him. And here, the Supreme Court may well say that a Bivens claim is actually unavailable. Why is that? Because under California law, you have all sorts of state law negligence claims, which actually seem like they're much stronger than whatever sort of federal constitutional claim you can bring under the Eighth Amendment. So, for example, under the Eighth Amendment, you have to show deliberate indifference. Under state law, all you would have to show is negligence. That seems much better for state law. Under state law, you would be able to get respondeat superior, so you would be able to get the entity. But as we've seen, under Bivens, you can't get the entity. Based on the previous cases, it seems that the prospects for Pollard are not that great because state law remedies are fairly good. It's a question, what does that mean? The state law remedies are fairly good. Here we know that this happened in California, but we have 50 states, so the state law remedies could be whatever. At the Supreme Court, just recently when the case was argued, they started arguing about how much overlap do you have to show among all of the different states. Is it enough to say that one state has bad remedies and then apply a Bivens remedy? The thing is, Bivens applies uniformly to everybody in the country. So surely you can't just say, well, California has good rules, therefore no one gets a Bivens remedy even in some other state. But what if every state except for, say, Maryland has good rules? Is it just because of Maryland that you can imply a Bivens remedy to everybody? So this is a difficult question. In Malesko, they explicitly did point to the existence of adequate state remedies. So it does seem that according to Supreme Court precedent, we should look to the adequacy of state remedies, among other things. It's just not clear what weight the state remedies should have, and do you have to do a 50-state survey, and how alike should all the state remedies be? At the same time, in some of the earlier cases, the Supreme Court has stressed that we need a Bivens remedy because we want national uniformity, and that's better than having a patchwork of 50 different state tort law things. That's something that's a little bit unclear, and hopefully this case will resolve that. So I think the bottom line is that the trend of Bivens jurisprudence suggests that Pollard is unlikely to succeed here, but at the same time, it's not clear just how much weight you give and in what way to the existence of state law remedies. Now, is all of this a good idea? It's true that federal courts are much more reluctant to allow Bivens remedies than to allow 1983 remedies, because 1983, as I've said, is a statute, and Bivens is just implied by federal courts as a matter of federal common law. And so as a matter of judicial role, you might think that this is proper. As a pure policy matter, I'm not sure that it makes sense. It seems to me that given the conditions in prisons, there are often not very many ways for prisoners to vindicate their rights, and the judicial remedy seems like an important way that they have to vindicate their rights, even given recent cutting back on prisoner court access like the Prison Litigation Reform Act. It seems that if you value prisoner access to courts, then there's not really any good reason for 1983 to apply so very broadly and Bivens to apply so very narrowly so that the state prisoners have much greater rights than the federal prisoners. So it's not necessarily a good thing that Pollard is probably going to lose, though if I had to bet, I would bet that he probably would lose, just because that seems to be the way that the limitations on the Bivens suits have been shaking out. So that's what we will hopefully see in the coming months.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.